The Kolani Gwala Show.
It is 12:05. A very good afternoon to you and a warm welcome to the Friday edition of the Kolani Gwala Show here on 702 in Cape Talk. It is the 18th of January 2019 and we're live for you from our Johannesburg studios. We're keeping you in touch with your world as it happens. All right then, some of the big stories on the show this afternoon, of course. We'll start with the latest coming out of the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. We are obviously hearing that from the former Bosasa Chief Operations Officer Angelo Agrizi, who is testifying at the moment. But there's also this other story. You would have heard it a little earlier on the Eusebius Makhaza show. The Secretary of the State Capture Commission of Inquiry, Dr. Khotso de Vere, is implicated in testimony before the commission by former Bosasa top boss Angelo Agrizi. News 24 reporting earlier on that Agrizi will name De Vere as a recipient of cash payments relating to a 2008 tender awarded by Bosasa subsidiary Sondolo IT by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for the installation of security systems at court, or that in courts around the country. So this is a developing one as well. We have put a call through to the spokesperson for the commission. They say they are preparing a statement at the moment. So if we get the statement before 1 o'clock, certainly we'll put them on the radio. But other than that, we'll ask Clement Manyatela if there's any development around the story. A big one. I mean, really, the commission itself, apparently. Well, I mean, if this story is anything to go by, the secretary of the commission, the heart of the commission, implicated in state capture. So certainly really worrying developments there. So we'll look at that story on the show.
The Kolani Gwala Show.
The Kolani Gwala Show.
On 702.
Another story. We've been here before. It's back again. Worries about the water situation across our country. There is a story in Business Day today, quoting the Water and Sanitation Department spokesperson, Sputnik Ratau, saying abnormally high demand for water, linked with soaring temperatures in Gauteng, has resulted in them asking us then, consumers, to actively cut back on our water usage. Dam levels apparently in the integrated Vaal River system have dipped below their levels of a year ago. So we will look at that story. It is a worrying development. We'll find out from Sputnik Ratau how bad is the situation. It's not just limited to Gauteng. There has been a story, in fact, I saw the story much earlier on in the week about what's going on in Cape Town. There was a municipality that requested emergency water help from charity organization Gift of the Givers to assist more than 14,000 people with drinking water. This is in the area of Laingsburg as well as Beaufort West. So there is a water crisis developing in that part of the country as well. Certainly we'll look at that. And again, if it affects you in one way or another directly, send me a quick text 31702 31567 or a voice note on 072-702-1702.
Kolani Gwala
on 702 and Cape Talk.
Another story. Did you see the story about the Lamborghini Springbok fly half Pat Lambie? Shame, he's reportedly set to announce his retirement from rugby. He's only 28 years old. Reports in French media state that Lambie is considering ending his career due to the effects of an accumulation of concussions. Reports say Patrick Lambie is seriously worried about his health, while French rugby publication Midi Olympique is reporting that he could end his career with immediate effect. Only 28, and certainly it looked like he had so much still to contribute to our rugby, but he unfortunately has got to cut his career short because of concussions. And I'd really like to talk about concussions. It's a subject that comes up over and over again. Towards the end of last year, I saw a report out of the UK that directly was talking about just how the problem of concussions in professional rugby has increased. It is out of proportion. It is just out of control completely. Now, the thing about it is that you've got to think, if it is that high in professional rugby, what about schools rugby? Maybe you are involved with schools rugby. And what we'll do later on is to talk to Dr. John Patricios. He always talks to us about this. He has been involved with issues of schools rugby and concussions for a very long time. But maybe you are a parent and your child has been affected by this. And it's not just about the big concussions that we see on TV that have symptoms. Apparently, it's also about the accumulation of the smaller ones and the impact that they have on the players themselves. So let me know. 011-883-0702. I'd be very happy to hear from you. 10 after 12.
702.
Kolani Gwala.
Weekdays,
12 to 1.
All right, so we'll go to the commission in a short while, but let's start with the issue of water. Water is life, and we see that the Department now of Water and Sanitation is saying, please, users, actively cut back on your water use because the dam levels, particularly in the integrated Vaal River system, have dipped way below the levels of a year ago. We're on the line to Sputnik Ratau. He speaks for the Department of Water and Sanitation. Mr. Ratau, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gwala, and thanks for your time.
Much appreciated. Thanks indeed for coming through. How bad is the water situation around the integrated Vaal River system?
Yes, the situation is such that it has gone down. When you look at it year on year, last year around this time we were at about 82.4% of the capacity of the integrated Vaal River system, whereas at the moment we are standing somewhere around 77.5%. Someone could say it's only about 5%, but 5% in terms of volume of water is quite a significant amount.
And what do you attribute all of this to?
Well, we are aware that we've been experiencing high temperatures due to the status quo in the weather system over the last few months, but also that the summer rains in the inland provinces have actually delayed a lot, because when you look at it, between September and December, we haven't had that much rainfall. We have had sporadic, showers here and there, but obviously it is important that our catchment areas be the ones that experience most of the rainfall so that we can be able to see a recharge of our water resources.
All right, so this is about the integrated Vaal River system, and I'm going to ask you about whether or not your call is appropriate. But I want to go to the Western Cape as well, because, as I mentioned, I've seen reports suggesting that certain parts of the Western Cape also maybe not a crisis yet, but heading that direction.
Yes, we do have concerns, especially around the areas of Beaufort West and so on. Where we are, Beaufort West, Laingsburg municipalities, those are the two particular municipalities that we are very, very concerned about. We have had engagements as the department with those municipalities as well as with province over the last few, week or so. That was to look at what the status is around the 9th of January and so on. And obviously what we agree upon is that, for instance, the Khamka Dam is completely empty, and that obviously that the reservoirs are at different levels, and that implies that the bulk water supply is under stress. But at the moment, under stress, yes, but not in a crisis level, because what we are looking at is that when reservoir 2 would reach about 11%, that would then be a situation that we could regard as a crisis. And that last happened about 2 years ago in December 2017.
So we've been through a situation where municipalities are getting involved and they're calling all on us to, of course, be careful about how we use water. And there are even sanctions for those who are recklessly using water. And is that what you're calling for now?
At the moment, we are calling for people to continue using water in a very great way, because you must remember that South Africa remains a water scarce country. It doesn't matter when, even when we're having the best of rainfall. And therefore, that is the one thing. The second thing is that in a number of municipalities, we've got a lot of other factors that affect water supply. That would be your aging infrastructure that leads to frequent leaks. That would be water theft by bypassing water meters as well by water users, and obviously a pipe burst resulting from implementation of water shedding sometimes, and so on and so forth. So there is quite a number of things that actually impact on availability of water supply.
And that is the problem, though. And people are saying, well, the department is quick to say we must be careful about how we use water, when in reality there are things that are well within your control as the department, such as dealing with issues of infrastructure, dealing with the quality of water in the Vaal River system. I mean, that is also a big issue on its own. Sort out those problems before you come back to us as consumers.
Which things are being sorted out when you look at it in the general sense, but also You must remember that reticulation is mainly located within local municipalities, and that is where you find a lot of capacity that is not available, whether it be technical capacity that is able to look after the infrastructure in terms of operations and maintenance. And sometimes it's also about being, the capacity to be able to spend the money that is supposed to be set aside for infrastructure operations and maintenance and development. So those are some of the things that we can have an impact as the national department up to a certain level. But obviously we have to work very, and we are now within the interministerial committee that includes cooperative governance, finance, and so on, looking at how we can then best be able to support our municipalities,
okay,
obviously, to be able to raise capacity.
All right. Sputnik Ratao speaks on behalf of the Department of Water and Sanitation. I'll take your comments. It's 16 minutes after 12.
Kulani Kwala on 702 and Cape Talk.
The story of the testimony of the former Bosasa's Chief Operations Officer Angelo Agrizi at the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture is just a fascinating, developing story, and there's just so much going on. Let's just go straight to our Clement Manyatela, who is on the line now to talk about the latest. Clement, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, actually.
Let me start with what is breaking news that I've just seen on EWN's Twitter timeline, that the ANC has been mentioned for the first time by Angelo Agrizi. Tell me more.
Yes, indeed. Geez, where do I even start? So what's happening here is that Angelo Agrizi has explained that Bosasa was once asked for money for electioneering by the ANC. Initially, he wasn't keen to disclose which political party had asked for it, but the Deputy Chief Justice asked that question again, and he ended up saying that it's the governing party. So it seems that the ANC in the Northwest, the government in the Northwest, there was an NEC who met with Bosasa's executives and asked for money for electioneering in that particular province. And the way that they did it was that, you know, the ANC government in the Northwest would pay Bosasa money for non-existent work. So millions of taxpayers' money would be paid to Bosasa for non-existent work. And the example we were given is that there were youth centers in the Northwest, which were facilitated by Bosasa, and they had software programs because that's what Bosasa was dealing with as a facilities and security company. And what the ANC government in the Northwest would do is pay Bosasa for those software programs for the youth center as though there were no software programs in the beginning. And then what Bosasa would do is take that payment from government, keep some of it, and then take the rest back to the African National Congress so that they can campaign for elections in that particular province. I think that's the simplest way, actually, I can try and explain it to you.
My, oh my. It's just, I mean, the ANC has consistently said it's not on trial. Yes, they've said that it's not about us, but clearly, more and more, they are getting directly involved in what is going on in state capture.
Yes, and this is just the beginning, XG, because remember yesterday, he did indicate, Angelo Agrizi, that he'll be mentioning about 38 people, including politicians, senior government officials, that have also benefited from the corruption that's been happening between Bosasa and government. So another thing that was very important that led Agrizi to now start talking about how they helped the ANC and they were approached by the ANC to help them with electioneering money is that they knew from the beginning that whatever money that they would give to the ANC would have to be laundered. And he does admit that he once met, together with other executives of Bosasa, met with an NEC in the Northwest who was a woman and was an NEC of social development. He doesn't remember the name at this point, but he's promised to come back to the commission with the name of that particular MEC. And it seems there were certain government officials in the Northwest who knew exactly what they were doing. They knew that they were paying Bosasa so much money for work that Bosasa didn't even do, because the software companies they were paying for were already installed by Bosasa at these youth centers that were already facilitated by this facilities company. The other important point that came out is how Bosasa was generating cash. Remember yesterday, Edgy, we were talking about how they were vaults and safes in the premises of Bosasa and how millions of rand were kept in those safes. And all that money, Agriti says, was used to pay bribes. Now, the question was, how do you get that money in there? Where does it come from? So he's given us a number of scenarios, and I'll probably just mention two of them to you, mm-hmm. on how they used to launder money. One of them was through liquor stores. So he says there were liquor stores like the Jumbo Liquor Store. That's the one that he mentioned, where Bosasa would order alcohol of about 4 million rand. And then the Jumbo Liquor Store would then invoice Bosasa for that 4 million rand, but no alcohol would be delivered. And then this Jumbo Liquor Store would then get its cash, because remember, most bars and restaurants go and buy alcohol cash from these liquor stores. So they always have this cash. So they're explaining that these liquor stores would then take the cash that they have and give it to an agent, the middleman, who would then take that money back to Bosasa. So that's one of the schemes and how they were able to generate cash by avoiding the law enforcement officers and avoiding going through the bank and withdrawing the money from the bank. And just lastly, another way was through the petrol station in Mpumalanga. They would, the petrol station would make so much money, they would then invoice, the petrol station would invoice Bosasa. Bosasa would pay the petrol station about 6 million rand, and then the petrol station would take 6 million rand in cash and then give it to Bosasa. That's how they were able to make this cash that they use for bribes and corruption.
Actively laundering money and also evading tax. But I just want to go back to something that you mentioned. Close to 40 people, he said, he's going to mention within government and the ANC, etc. And there's a story, I don't know whether there's any development in it from where you are, of the secretary then of the commission, Dr. Khotso de Vier, who according to the News 24 is implicated in the testimony. Apparently he took money back in 2008 from the very same Bosasa.
Yes, and at the time she was working for the Department of Justice and Correctional Services. Apparently, according to this investigative report by News 24, Dr. Khotso de Vier was actually getting cash payments monthly, which Agrisi apparently will confirm at this testimony that that money amounts to about 15 million rand. And this person used to get that money through a middleman. Now, ironically, that same company that got, the same company that got this tender from the Department of Justice, Solani, in 2008, is the same company that was given a contract last year by the State Capture Commission to also help with security, installing some security software and cameras here at the State Capture Commission. And then News 24 reported about it and how it's a subsidiary of Bosasa. And then the Deputy Chief Justice, Raymond Zondo, then had to stop that contract from operating here at the State Capture Commission. The question then is, did this contract and it being attained by this subsidiary of Bosasa have any links with Dr. de Vier, who clearly had a relationship with this company in 2008 through this, when she was given these cash payments? And there's no development at this point, but we're expecting that the Deputy Chief Justice, Raymond Zondo, may address that issue sometime towards the end of the commission. So normally when there are issues bubbling under or that have been reported by other media houses, he waits until the end of the commission before he can address those matters. But it's really, really important to know where she is now, because remember, as a secretary of this commission, she has access to the affidavits, to the submissions that come here by the witnesses that come to testify at the commission.
My, oh my. All right, Clement, I've got to let you go. There's just so much happening. Thank you for now. Much appreciated. Clement Manyatela is at the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. Of course, the big headline at the moment is that Bosasa gave laundered money to the ANC in the Northwest Province for electioneering. What is your response? Send me a quick text, 31702-31567, or you can use WhatsApp line. Our WhatsApp line is 072-702-17. 702, 25 after 12. 12, thank you very much for staying with us. I want to look at the story now of Patrick Lambie, who, according to reports in France, is considering ending his career due to the effects of an accumulation of concussions. Now, reports say Lambie is seriously worried about his health, while French rugby publication Midi Olympique is reporting that he could end his career with immediate effect. Now, we know about some of the struggles that he's had with concussion. Remember, there was a game in which he was badly injured. I think it was in Cape Town back in 2016. Apparently, that's been followed by a number of other concussions and a number of other injuries to him. But I suppose what this does is, again, brings to the focus this issue of concussions in rugby and whether or not something is being done about it, not only at professional levels, but also what about schoolboy rugby, school rugby? What about other levels of the game? What is being done? I mean, I'm not talking about the professional specifically. Let's turn now to Professor John Patricios, who is Director of Sports Concussion South Africa. Professor, nice talking to you. Good afternoon.
Tolani, good afternoon to you.
Thank you for your time. I know you've looked at this issue in South Africa and we've spoken about it so many times, but I saw a report towards the end of last year. It was from the UK, and it was saying that the rate of these concussions in the professional rugby game are unacceptably high and that the sport must change in order to keep the players safe. Do you concur?
Absolutely. Certainly the incidence, the recorded incidence, has increased considerably over the last decade or so. But we have to be a little bit careful in interpreting those statistics, because we're also on the lookout for concussions far more than we were before. So we're noting concussions a lot more, and our diagnosis, our criteria for diagnosing concussions are far broader than they were. So we're far more cautious, which is actually a good thing. So the fact that we're picking these up now, whereas in the past they were ignored, is actually a positive outcome.
It's interesting you say that, because this report that I'm referring to, and it was published by the BBC, was saying that the problem is that the rugby authorities internationally are not doing nearly enough. That the sanctions for contact to the head, for instance, in games, have no impact in dealing with these concussions.
Yeah, I'd probably argue against that to a degree, because I think rugby union has taken a lead, actually. And although in the past you could say that a lot of these injuries were ignored and some of the tackling mechanisms that led to concussions weren't punished, the law changes that have come into place over the last couple of years have certainly had a significant impact in reducing the types of high tackles and contact situations which may lead to more serious head and neck injuries. So I think the authorities have taken cognizance of it. The rules have been changed, and the authorities, the referees in particular, have been given license to punish foul play more significantly than ever in the past. And certainly that's not going to get rid of any concussions. You never will in any sport. But in terms of the contact and collision sports, I think rugby union has certainly taken a lead, and many other sports have followed rugby's lead in changing the rules to try and reduce it.
But of course, that's at the level of the professional game, right? What about schools rugby?
Well, your point is very valid. So these professionals, such as Patrick Lambie, the example you mentioned, have teams of medical experts around them all the time. So they have access to the latest technology and protocols. So what's very, very important is to make sure that the best care is available to schoolboys who have young developing brains, to young boys and girls who might be riding horses and bicycles, etc., because it's not just rugby where we see concussions.
Sure.
And so that's why we have these protocols, which originated in professional sport, and now, you know, through the programs that we run through Sports Concussion South Africa, we have now implemented at school level to be able to make those protocols and technologies accessible to young people.
Professor Patricio Samas, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for coming on.
You're most welcome.
Much appreciated. I'll take comments, by the way, from parents, maybe teachers who are involved with school sports generally, but rugby in particular. And perhaps what are your experiences there? 31702-31567. All right, it is now 22 minutes before 1. So just a couple of days ago, the Transport Minister, Dr. Bladen Zimande, gave the festive road season fatalities, and apparently over 1,600 people died over the festive season in this country. And one of the things that he raised was the role of drunken drivers in all of this, that we have way too many people who are driving drunk, and that we've got to change and maybe reschedule that offense of drunken driving in this country. And I mean, something that people have raised before. But there's an interesting story, an interesting debate, and it was on Cape Talk again yesterday. It's about the old road accident fund. It's about to be called, I think, the Road Accident Benefit Scheme. There's a bill before Parliament, but it is also talking about the changes. And the story is that despite negligence and drunk driving being the main causes of these fatal road accidents that I've spoken about, drunk drivers will be able to claim compensation under the proposed Road Accident Benefit Scheme. That's according to lawyers who have been looking at this bill. In fact, an article in The Citizen is quoting DSC attorney's lawyer Kirsty Haslam, who says drunk and negligent drivers will be fully covered in terms of the proposed bill. This will reduce the compensation paid to accident victims and their dependents. Is that really so? Let's turn now to Mr. Leonard Ramatlakane. He is a member of the Transport Committee in Parliament. Of course, these are the people who currently are dealing with this bill. And Mr. Ramatlakane, nice talking to you. Hello.
Thank you very much, Kolani, and of course the listenership.
Much appreciated. Is that a true interpretation of what the bill is saying, that even reckless and drunk drivers can still claim from what was known as the Road Accident Fund?
Kolani, let me just thank you for the question. I think it's an important question, and also to clarify this. First of all, the current law as it stands, the RAF, it's a law that was based on anybody must prove that they are not guilty of an accident. Now, that law as it stands hadn't happened to exclude lots of people from claiming the accident, because they would say, let's employ the expert to come and look at whose fault was it that the accident happened. And therefore, those who happen to be occupants and everybody that is part of the people who say they maybe it's the one that was speeding or whatever reason may be, they are subjected to that particular fault. If you have not been able to pass that test, that you argue, instead that involve lawyers and everybody else to go and measure their roads and find out whose fault it was that two cars had involved in an accident. And based on their report, the one that is in fault go to court and argue that, and then of course the other one will obviously not benefit, which is in fact applicable to those who were part of parcel of that particular accident. Mm. So the new law, therefore, the scheme seems to say the internationally, this whole thing about fault is a problem. So we must be able to say if the people were involved in an accident, they are eligible to claim from the benefit scheme, because those two cars were involved in an accident. It won't require that you now have to employ the lawyers to go and measure the road to say it was an engineering problem on the road, that's why this car involved in an accident, which is what normally consume lots of money towards the lawyers instead of going to benefit those who are victims. So then the law says we are abolishing, we're doing away with this fault, this no fault issue. Mm. So everybody can then submit claims in terms of the new act. But here is the point. Now, in the act, the bill itself, the law, because we have passed it in Parliament, we're just waiting for the NCOP to finalize it. It says this act does not necessarily repeal the Criminal Procedure Act. There's an act that is in existence now, which if anybody has committed something, it has been confirmed that he has committed something, that person is prosecuted. Let's say the driver was drunk. That driver still has to pass through that particular Criminal Procedures Act to be found that that driver was in fact was drunk. Therefore, that issue will be managed through that particular existing act.
All right, but let me understand how it works then, Mr. Ramatlakane. So a drunk driver can still then claim, but still go through the Criminal Procedure Act. In other words, I will claim, get the benefits, but if I was drunk and proven drunk, then go through the criminal justice system.
No. When the accident happens, everybody report the accident, that there was an accident, so many people were injured. Then that everybody that was part of that accident, both accident, then report the accident. And then there's a process, therefore, to say if it's a driver on the scene and is drunk, obviously the law enforcement will say this driver, based on the test that we do, is drunk and is basically arrested. That driver basically is going to be following the normal procedure of the act to find him guilty in terms of what he has done, in terms of that the culpable homicide issue kicks in. But it does not, it allows the people that were in the vehicle that was driving, was driven by a drunk driver, to still be eligible to claim based on the benefit scheme. So they are not subjected to say, the driver that was driving you was drunk, and therefore the driver is not qualifying, and therefore is not recognized as an accident that has taken place. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the bridge that must be crossed, you need to take through the people through the clearing house. This one is an accident. This one was drunk, was under the influence. There can be measure. There can be confirmed that in fact was over limit, and therefore the accident has caused by him.
Here's a final question.
Another issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's another issue that has been raised, which I had to listen to.
Oh.
Is this issue about the hijacking?
Yeah.
People who are involved in the hijack. Again, this very same act makes provision that those people that are involved in that kind of crime are not necessarily going to take refuge under this benefit scheme. In other words, if it's a terrorist, this is going to be dealt in terms of the existing act to make sure that they are punished accordingly.
I hear that.
And therefore,
I saw your report saying that it was a late amendment that says that if you're convicted of what is referred to as what, Schedule 1 offense, criminally, you are then excluded. But the issue is that wasn't this an opportunity, given the problem that we have of drunken driving, was this not an opportunity to make sure that you punish and exclude those who are who drive drunk, and make sure that you explicitly punish them using this law?
The conduct of the people who drink and drive is not necessarily abolished. It's not protected by this act. That act that deals with the issue of offense, so many are beyond the limit, that is applicable. Those people are still going to be punished based on that particular act. This act is not repealing all of that. That's remaining in place. The only thing that it's addressed by this new act is that don't say that the 10 people that was in the vehicle, so-called alleged driver that was under the influence, they are subjected to the process that this driver that was under the influence was able to go through before they claim. Because remember, there's two cars involved in an accident, or maybe one car involved in an accident. Then the driver was behavior. Then everything else is going to be constrained by whether this driver was drunk or not. So what the new act says, this driver will be dealt with in terms of the existing act, but everybody else that was in the vehicle that was driven by this drunk driver must be accepted as the people that were involved in the accident, therefore qualified.
Yeah, but won't the benefits to everybody else then who is in the car be reduced?
The benefit would not be reduced because you remember the calculation of the existing, the whole thing about the actuarial's report in terms of whether the person has a broken leg, already that has already been determined how the calculation happens. It won't be reduced. The only thing that this new law says is that this, because it's a benefit scheme, it is not a lump sum payment and you walk away. It has to be paid over a period of time that you have been paid this particular benefit, because that benefit that must take care of you until what happened ever into your life. The current problem is that the lump sum payment that happens, Polani, is that after the payment has happened, 2 months, 3 months down the line, the very lump sum payment that has been paid to that particular victim is blown out and there's nothing, and the person is suffered, continue to suffer because the money either has been spent by this and the other, or the money has been either stolen and all of that. So this is also to protect those people who are victims in terms of paying them a monthly payment, because it's a scheme forever.
Okay. All right, Mr. Leonard Ramatlakane, I've got to thank you for your time, member of the Transport Committee in Parliament.
Polani Gwala on 702. For the curious.
It is now 9 minutes before one. I'll look at some of your SMSs. A very interesting one from Claudia in relation to the story about concussions that we were doing earlier on, who says, hello, Polani. I'm also interested in soccer-related concussions. I would have liked to hear the professor's view on... By the way, the professor was quite general about this, that it's not just rugby-related, but yeah, I hear your point, where Claudia is saying, I would have liked to hear the professor's view on children playing soccer and headers. The long-term impact of soccer's headers also worries me. I wonder if anyone else, perhaps who plays football, does it worry you? Do the headers also lead to concussions? It's a story that I've actually never looked at very closely. So maybe somebody has and would like to respond to what Claudia is saying. Please do give me a call. It's 8 minutes now before one. So shortly I'm going to talk to JJ Cornish. We'll talk about the developments surrounding the disputed election in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But there's a breaking story surrounding Solim Simanga and his role as the executive mayor in Tshwane. Thando Kubeka is looking at that story. If we are able to get it out of the press conference, certainly we'll bring it on. If not, we'll tell you about it. But you'll hear on EWN as well at the top of the hour. It's 8 minutes now before one.
Polani Gwala on 702 and Cape Talk.
The African Union, ASI, yesterday called on the DRC to suspend the release of the final results of its disputed presidential election due to doubts over the provisional results. Remember that Felix Tshisekedi, leader of the Congolese main opposition party, the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, as well as a presidential candidate, Felix Tshisekedi was announced as the leader there. The announcement by the AU is pretty rare, but it follows all sorts of controversies surrounding the announcement that was made by the electoral authorities. The opposition leader and runner-up Martin Fayulu is in court, has taken the matter to the Constitutional Court. Let's find out the latest, and we're on the line to JJ Cornish, EWN Africa correspondent. JJ, good to talk to you. Hi.
Hello and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you, JJ. Thanks indeed. All right, then tell us the latest from the AU around the DRC's disputed poll.
It's interesting that the SADC organ, which is the organ on double troika, which is the organ on politics, defense and security, and then the political leadership, past, present and the next one in line, in both cases, when they met yesterday in Addis Ababa, they simply congratulated the Congolese on having elections, the normal SADC line, you know. The point is, it was left to the Continental Group, because the six, the double troika, went off and met the Great Lakes group, and then they also met the commission. Mm. And it was the larger group that asked the Congolese to suspend the elections. Now, it has been not quite bloodless, but it's been much calmer than we feared it would be. And it's believed that if the provisional results are simply confirmed by the government, there will be huge violence. Now, the Constitutional Court, at the behest of Martin Fayulu, is looking at maybe recounting ballots. Now, its judgment was going to come out, could be as early as today. I mean, in terms of the official timetable, the results should have been announced today. But they're saying stay this because you're not, they use the phrase serious doubts. Now, they are sending a high-level delegation, the AU is, to the Congo, and they will urgently dispatch this delegation to look at reaching a consensus on the way out of the crisis, or post-electoral crisis. So we have grown-up problems in that part of the world, I'm afraid, Polani. But at the moment, there's nothing anybody can do if one of the parties decides, well, we're going to go ahead with it and push for it. I think Martin Fayulu's supporters have held back, and we hope that they continue to do this.
Now, you spoke a little earlier on about SADC and just that normal line congratulating the people of the DRC for the election, etc. They seem divided to me. I mean, I spoke yesterday to the spokesperson for the Department of International Relations and Cooperation here in South Africa, and he then seems to say that the statement that was issued by the Zambian president was issued in his capacity as the Zambian president and has nothing to do with SADC. And this is the statement in which the Zambian president was saying there must be a recount.
Yes, indeed. So there's a lot of confusion. At one point, it was the South Africans were quoted as saying, we need a government of national unity. Well, that's the oldest South African line, isn't it? When we have a real problem, we go for national unity in the hope that that will avert violence. But briefing diplomats on Tuesday, Durko actually said, no, that's not what we're wanting. We don't want a government of national unity. And they're pushing also for a look at stay the hand and see what the Constitutional Court says. Bide our time, but don't make any hard-line decision that's going to drive people onto the streets. So really, we're playing a waiting game, I'm afraid.
All right, JJ Cornish. Listen, for now, I must thank you very much. We're monitoring the story as it develops, of course. JJ Cornish is EWN Africa correspondent. Thanks indeed. 3 before 1.
Polani Gwala on 702.
For the curious.
All right, stay tuned. EWN will be reporting in a moment on the breaking story surrounding Tswane Mayor Solim Simanga. But I wanted to squeeze the story very quickly around what's happening in Zimbabwe now. I see that the largest mobile network operator in Zimbabwe, Econet Wireless, has notified millions of subscribers that it received another directive to shut down internet access, a move that obviously has been criticized, particularly by activists here in South Africa. And speaking of activists, Right to Know campaign is picketing right this moment outside the Zimbabwean embassy, and they say this is in solidarity with the people of Zimbabwe. Let's quickly hear about that. We're on the line to Bongani Xezwi, outreach organizer at Right to Know. Bongani, very briefly, in a very, very short statement, what on earth is happening outside the Zimbabwean embassy?
Essentially, what we have come here to do is to try and put as much pressure as we possibly can to the embassy to try and address some of the issues that are happening internally in Zimbabwe, primarily because of the internet shutdown. It makes it difficult for us to get some information coming out. We think this is a violation of people's right to protest, as we see the military repression on the citizens, as well as the internet shutdown. For us, it makes it difficult then, therefore, for people to actually access information and exchange information, which is a constitutional right.
All right, just a final question. So are you demonstrating against the Zimbabwean embassy, or also, because I heard earlier on that you are concerned about the South African government's reaction to what is happening in Zimbabwe?
Essentially, we're doing both. One of the things that we've been doing, actually, is to kind of put pressure on the embassy itself to self-reflect, but also we've released a couple of statements to highlight our disappointment in regards to how the South African government has been mum. I mean, I think it's the whole quiet diplomacy strategy that's not been working for us over the years. Mm. So we feel we need to also highlight the fact that the South African government is actually way too quiet for our neighbors. And we are hoping we'll do both actions, one, trying to put pressure on the embassies of Zimbabwe and as well as on the South African government. So we are grateful for people like 702 and other media agencies that actually put us on the map in the country as well. For us to be able to highlight the issue that the corrupting government's response has been very disappointing.
All right, Bongani Mxezwe, outreach organizer at the Right to Know campaign. Listen, thank you very much for listening to the show. We're back on Monday. Have a fantastic weekend. Cheers.